When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 147. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading down to Bristol to talk to The Voice journalist, BBC Farming Today and Country Farm presenter Charlotte Smith. Charlotte, how are you?
I'm fine. Hello.
I'm good. Thrilled to be speaking to you. How's lockdown affected you? Are you able to get out and about a bit now?
No, yeah, lockdown was hard. I was shielding because I have what's commonly known as weird lungs. And so I was advised to shield. And there's a proper way of shielding where you literally live in one room and people hand you things through the door. And because I do have a functioning immune system, I can't do that. So basically, yeah. I was in the house and then everybody else, the rest of the family went out, which just... I am quite a control freak. I find giving somebody else a shopping list and it coming back in a slightly, you know, they interpret the shopping list, which I found difficult. But I did get quite bored. And I got a bit bored. I watched a lot of telly. I'm judging a conservation writing competition, so I read all the books, which is quite handy. And obviously, thank God, I was able to work. I did work for Farming Today. I lost a lot of telework, obviously, because when you ring up and say, I'm really sorry, I can't leave the house, they tend to say, okay, we'll find someone else. Luckily, I could do Farming Today from home, and that was a real godsend for me, actually. It kept me sane.
Oh, but now, I suppose, like every other job, you have had to change the way you work during the COVID-19 crisis. Has that been a challenge for broadcasters? I mean, I guess one of the most important aspects of your job is talking to people face to face. How have you found doing these things remotely?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've found it a little bit difficult, but because increasingly we talk to people either from a studio or down the line, or increasingly, particularly with farmers, I can ring you on your landline, you can record it on your mobile phone and send it, and it sounds really good quality. So actually, that wasn't too difficult. The really hard thing I found was just not being around the rest of the team. So you have the morning meeting over Zoom or whatever, that's fine. But then I might have an idea, and in the office, I'd say, why don't we do this? And someone else would say, that's rubbish, but let's do X, Y, and Z. And we'd build on my initially rubbish idea and come up with something good. And that's sort of gone because you don't have that informal chatting. So I've really missed that. And I am I'm quite a social creature, so I've really missed the gossip, to be honest. You know, just the gossip of an office and the laughs and the taking the mick, you know, but I've missed that. The hardest thing actually has been broadband. So for me, it's relatively straightforward because it's pretty much like doing this.
Yeah.
But for producers, they need to download it, edit it, and then upload it again. And quite a few, even living in Bristol, have found that their broadband can't take it. Just been very frustrating because something that usually takes, I don't know, a minute is taking an hour or an hour and a half. So that's been really hard.
Welcome to the world of amateur podcasting. That's what I contend with on a weekly basis. But no, it's been difficult, hasn't it? And I was speaking to someone the other day, and apparently a lot of even government ministers have struggled with their broadband. So hopefully it'll focus the minds on improving it a little bit going forward.
Well, particularly because, you know, the schools have been doing lessons online and stuff. Yeah. I've got friends who have been like, well, we can't do that. It just doesn't work. So they've had to get sent everything in big packs.
Yeah.
And you think, well, for that kid, it's just even more isolating, isn't it? So, hopefully it'll be a big kick up the backside. But we've said that before, haven't we?
We have. You grew up in rural Leicestershire. Did you have any farming background at all?
God, no, not at all. I mean, I lived in a village. And I knew farmers and I knew what farms were. And that was the extent of my interest, if I'm absolutely honest. I couldn't wait to leave said village. And in fact, I go back a lot. My parents still live there, and it makes me laugh because now I think, God, it'd be nice to live here.
Yes.
It's got lots of space and a village green and a shop and a this and a that. But at the time, I didn't want to live in a village. I was going to, you know, be an actress and, or do something interesting. So no, it was slightly wasted on me, actually, looking back.
Yeah. Your parents were librarians, though.
Yeah. Yeah, they met, well, we always tease them that they met behind a book stack in what was the West Riding of Yorkshire. My dad's from London and my mum's from Yorkshire. And they ended up sort of in the middle in Leicestershire. They liked living in a village, neither of them from a village, but my mum grew up in town, my dad grew up in South London during the war. So a really different experience for them. I mean, now the village is actually very big, but at the time it was relatively small and we weren't local in that sense because they didn't come from there. So we weren't plugged into that rural community, really. Sure. But it was a great place to grow up. I mean, really,
you know. And as the child of librarians, were there sort of books all over the house? Were you a big reader?
Yes. And they were all, you know, obviously classified in the Dewey Decimal System. And we used to park the car, you know, with the Dewey Decimal System. So we were parking in ancient Greece or something. I must remember where it was. So yes, books were very much a part of life. My mum particularly is a voracious reader and has been a book club now since I was born, just before I was born. I think it's 58 years now. I'm 55. So in fact, she's just left it at the age of 87.
Wow. So
that was a book a week, you know. So and as I got older, I would read those books as well. So I've always been a big reader. I love reading. I can't do it on a screen. It has to be a proper book.
I'm the same, actually. I'm a big reader, and I've tried to read with the iPad and things. I just can't get on with it.
No, me neither. No. And I can't tell you why I can't get on with it.
No,
and I feel silly for not being able to get on with it. But
Me too. I think it's just the feel of the pages. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, my Google stalking before this interview revealed that you were, in fact, head girl in your school.
Oh, no.
Were you a very diligent and well-behaved in school?
No. I went to a girls' school, former grammar school.
Yeah.
Private by the time I got there, to my parents' delight. I missed it by a year. And it was great. It was a really good school. I really actually enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But no, I wasn't. I came bottom in the A form every single year. And in fact, years later, at a school reunion, the old deputy head told me that I was only in the A form because I was articulate, because my results weren't up to it. So that explained a lot. Yes, I wasn't a head girl because I was good at the academic side of things. I was good at the talking side of things.
Yeah, okay.
And so that's what got me there, yeah. And I was really proud to be head girl, but it has been one of those things I've slightly had to live down ever since. Because I thought it was great and I was really proud of myself. But it is a bit embarrassing, isn't it, now? But yeah, naturally bossy.
Yeah.
Underlined management potential, that's how I like to look at it.
Well, exactly. You planned to be an actor, though. Were you quite an extrovert then, as a child?
Yes. I'm very good at showing off. I thought I could be an actor. I thought that was a realistic option, because I was in school plays, and so I did English and drama at university. So I asked. I wanted to go to drama school, and my parents, neither of whom went to university, they both got places, but we weren't allowed to go for family reasons, basically because they couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So I'm the first in our extended family to go, and it was a really big deal. So so off I went to do English and drama, and actually, you know, got involved with plays and got involved, and thank God had a realization on a stage, actually, in one of these plays, and I was right down at the front of the stage sort of doing some interactive stuff with the audience, and then watching somebody else pick that up and do it 10 times better. And just thinking, I'm quite good at this, but I'm not good enough. And I can't sing and I can't dance. And this is not going to be the career for me.
Okay.
I'm really glad I had that realization, because I now know lots of actors who are successful working actors, you know, people my age who've managed to stay the course.
Yeah.
But they're not rich. They're not famous. And it's hard, and it's constant rejection, and I would be really bad at that.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I didn't chance it. I just wasn't good enough. You've got to be so good. Yeah. And I was all right.
Yeah. Okay. So how did you first get involved in radio and journalism?
Well, that happened actually when I was at school. So we did public speaking, and I did quite a lot of that. It's one of the things I like best about actually about young farmers, that they teach people to talk in a public setting, because I think it's such a useful confidence boosting skill. Anyway, so I did a bit of that, and our local radio station, Radio Leicester, sponsored it. And so I don't think I won, but I got involved that way. And got involved with youth programs on Radio Leicester for a few years. And then when I was at university, I got involved with the campus radio and things like that, and then carried on working in local radio in the summer holidays, and was just completely bitten by the bug. And I was very lucky because I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So I didn't, I didn't have to. I mean, I had a plan B, obviously. But I was pretty determined to at least give it a shot.
Yeah, okay. And then you got into the BBC trainee radio reporter.
Yeah, this was the local radio trainee reporter scheme, which I joined in 1986, probably. Okay. Yeah, 86. So I was the same intake as Clive Myrie and Carolyn Quinn and Sean Williams and various others who are now really important at the BBC, and me and a few others who one guy now does the PR for the Olympics. We've gone in all sorts of different directions. And it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. We started off in London learning the basics about, how to hold a microphone and the studio and all of that, and also law and libel and that sort of thing. And then they just threw you out to a local radio station who had you as a free pair of hands for 3 months.
Okay.
So I worked all around the country, which was brilliant. And then after that, you went on to the radio reporter reserve for local radio. So when they needed someone, they sort of could plug gaps.
Yes.
And I did that for a few years. And then I ended up, actually, because my mum wasn't very well, I ended up back at Radio Leicester because that was convenient to be around for her. Mm-hmm. And obviously she got better and I stayed at Radio Leicester on home ground, which was a real privilege, actually.
Yeah. So the job must have been very different then. No internet, no mobile phones, etc., which are all sort of just such a part of our lives now, aren't they? So I guess a lot more legwork, I presume. But are the principles still the same?
Yes, I mean, it's basically nosiness, isn't it? So it's the job for me. I'm really nosy. I hear things on trains. I just like to know what's going on. So incredibly different. I mean, people laugh now when I tell them this, but we used to have the newsroom. You used to have your desk, and it had a typewriter on it.
Yeah.
And then it had a ledge, and on the ledge was an ashtray. And then after lunch, numerous people would also have a takeaway pint of beer because we all went to the pub for lunchtime, and my generation looked down on because we had shandies. But the older people in the newsroom would have a pint and a fag and be tapping it all out, So it's so different. And yes, people would actually have to talk to each other, and it would take you ages to track somebody down.
Yeah.
You'd ring the post office to see if they knew where blah, blah lived. And when you tell people now, they look at you like you're completely insane.
But it was
really different.
Yeah. What was it that initially appealed about the job and the life? Was it the variety or the people?
I think it's the people. It was it's being part of a team. And again, it is the nosiness.
Yeah.
And it's exciting. We had, when there's a big news story, I was reading the 2 o'clock news as the most junior person in the newsroom. You got to read the 2 o'clock news because it meant you couldn't go to the pub at 1 o'clock. So you stayed and read the 2 o'clock news. So I'm reading the 2 o'clock news and the phone goes and it's the police. And they say 2 men have just escaped from Gartree prison in a helicopter.
Wow. Okay.
And I went, really? Or something equally incisive. And they went, yes. So I put the phone down, rang the pub, and rang the news editor, who came running back in. And I've tapped out everything I know. And I go and read it on the 2 o'clock Radio Leicester News. And he takes what must have been 3-4 lines and does a live piece into Radio 4. Pint in one hand. It was, and stuff like that. It was fantastic.
Oh,
it was brilliant.
And was it, I guess it must have been coming from sort of rural Leicestershire, being in London in the 80s, a real sort of buzz about the place. Must have been just brilliant.
Yeah.
Vibe, I guess.
I'm trying to think, when did I get to London? I didn't get down to London till probably the 90s. I went, the late 80s. I went on an attachment. The BBC has this thing where Radio Leicester will lend you to somebody else for six months. And I went for a job on the Today programme, a trainee producer on the Today programme, and and you have to do a board. So you've got four or five people asking you questions. And I was, you know, the confidence of youth. I was so arrogant. Anyway, and I kept saying, you must do this and you must do that. And I obviously didn't get the job. But The World Tonight rang me up and said, come to us. Now, The World Tonight at the time specialised in foreign affairs and was staffed by a lot of much older people, all of whom were absolutely expert and spoke two or three languages each. And then there was me at the end of the table, you know, and I used to... All the news programmes at the time were on a corridor in Radio 4. And at the end of the corridor was something called news information, which is where they kept all the cuttings from newspapers about particular areas. So you could go in and you could say, give me Afghanistan, and you'd get all the latest stuff on Afghanistan because there's no internet. You know, there's no other way of finding out. So I would sit in these morning meetings and they'd all chat on and I'd be unusually silent, and then I'd run down to news information and say, they've said this, this and this, what the heck are they talking about, and get the cuttings and kind of read it up so that I could then help set up the program. It was I was so privileged to do that because it was a fantastic learning experience. I was so far out of my depth, it was hilarious, but it was great.
Now, as you progressed through your career at the BBC, you worked in radio and TV. For those of us who don't know and have never been involved in either, what's the main difference between working on the two?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In TV, there's generally more of you. You're more of a team.
Yeah.
But the main difference is that if I say to you in a conversation on the radio or in a podcast, it's just the words, that's all we've got. So I can describe something to you and you have a mental image and on we go. In TV, I can describe the same thing, but if the pictures are doing something else, you'll remember the pictures, not what I'm trying to say. So you've got to try to marry the two without doing what's called Lord Privy Seal, which is after a Monty Python sketch where they say Lord and you see a picture of Lord, Privy, a picture of a loo, and Seal, a picture of a seal. And you've got to try and avoid that. But often in TV, you know, I'd be doing things because I worked initially in regional news in the Midlands, again in Nottingham. And so you'd be doing, all you'd have is a picture of people going into a room. And so you'd say, while so-and-so were meeting, such and such and such happened. Which is basically, I haven't got the pictures for that. So that's the main difference, that the pictures are the most important thing. And I'm a very verbal person, in case you haven't realised. And so I have always fought against that. And it's a standing joke with one of my colleagues at Country File that I would, my first script would always be 85 million words. which I didn't have enough room for. And then we'd pare it back. Because actually the best people who write for telly, Clive Murray actually is an example now, speak naturally for a start, but also write very little.
And
give them to breathe. And it's a real skill that I am aspiring to.
I guess it's like almost the sort of classic sports commentators. I'm a bit nerdy about that, and they knew that, you know, whether it be Test Match Special or the classic sort of football rugby commentary, they knew the power of a pause, didn't they?
And actually commentating is really hard. I've never even tried, but I used to work with Ian Carter at Radio Leicester, who's now the golf correspondent. Nick Mullins was there as well. He does rugby, doesn't he? And various others. And watching them almost learn to commentate, because you always have to... I was a sports journalist for a while, long story, but I was a sports journalist for a while when I was at telly. And it was a very male environment, so it was tricky. it was really tricky, actually. It was nasty looking back. But the skill of commentating is amazing. It's so hard.
Yeah.
Because which bit do you miss out? Which, particularly on radio, you've got to give people a sense of what's going on. Yeah. No, I love listening to commentary. I find Test Match, but I'm not particularly interested in cricket, but I love listening to Test Match Special.
That's the beauty of it. I don't think you have to be interested in cricket, do you? It's just lovely to have on in the background, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
Just mentioning that then, in sports journalism and you being sort of one of the only women, has that changed a lot in the time you've been there?
Hugely. And that's really good because, you know, loads of women are interested in sport. You know, I wasn't interested enough. I think in sports journalism, it's got to be your passion and you've got to kind of know and care who won the cup in 1950 kind of thing. And I don't and didn't.
Yes.
But yes, that's hugely changed. So when I first started, I was one of two women who would be regularly covering, and I covered football in the East Midlands. So I was doing Cloughy at Nottingham Forest at the end of Cloughy. And then, amazing.
Did you get to interview?
I mean, badly, you know. So the most exciting thing that ever happened to me was that I had a knee operation, which is my hobby. I'd had a knee operation, and I was actually having my physio at Notts County.
Okay.
Because Neil Warnock had sorted it out for me. And they had, it was really funny. They didn't quite know how to cope with me because I was so unfit. So if you imagine, they're used to dealing with all these footballers who've got proper thigh muscles, and they look at me and just go, where are your muscles? So I'm on crutches, and I've got a thigh to ankle sort of bandagey thing on.
Yeah.
I go down to cover training at Forest.
Yeah.
And Cluffy's there, and there was this guy, Mark Crossley, who was the goalkeeper, and he was in trouble for whatever reason with Cluffy. And so as I arrive on my crutches, making my painful way across the grass, you know, to watch training and put together a report, he says, young man, and he puts me in goal. So I'm in goal on my crutches, and there's Stuart Pearce coming towards me. I'm thinking, oh my god, shoot wide. Bless him, he did shoot extremely wide, because I was just like, I just had this knee done, you know, for that.
That's so incredible.
I mean unbelievable, really. So there were some really good fun times, but it wasn't really me, that job, to be honest. Yeah. And so I went from there to do the news side of Five Live, which was ideal. So I'm a news journalist with an understanding of sports.
Yes.
Actually, people I work with at Five Live, if they were here, would be falling off their chairs laughing at that point. But who claimed an understanding of sports, and that worked much better.
Yeah. You were part of the launch team for Five Live. It must be incredible to see where that's gone to now, because it's so good, isn't it, Five Live?
Unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. That's slightly irritating, you know, because you kind of think, you know, when I leave, the place will fall apart. And I was there for about 5-6 years. I absolutely loved it. And I probably stayed a bit longer than I should have, really. It's brilliant. And I didn't listen for many years because I was a bit, but now I listen all the time and I love it.
Yeah. They do some brilliant specials, don't they? Think, you know, it's quite obviously all based around sport. But I listened to a brilliant program a year or so ago about sort of mental health problems with cricketers and things like that. You know, there's some real hard hitting stuff as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and they did. I mean, one thing we did while we were there, we worked on, I can't remember who did it, but we worked on something about what it was like being a footballer in the fourth division, the old fourth division. Because we were always hearing from these, you know, glamorous stars who were earning a gazillion quid. And we just thought, what's it like to be a journeyman footballer?
Yeah.
So it's amazing. You're making money from your sport, but, you know.
Yeah.
There are always creative people, and that's, you know, when they can be given the space to just go off and do something like that. I made a program on Millwall, which was just all about the people who keep Millwall running, like the tea lady and stuff.
Yeah.
Brilliant. It was really interesting.
Fantastic. So when did you first become involved with Farming Today?
Well, that was a complete and utter accident. So I'd worked on You and Yours, which is the Radio 4 consumer program. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the BBC was having one of its regular reorganizations. Yeah. And it was being run by the people who ran Watchdog. And so they came across and said to me, oh, you'd be great on Watchdog. And I thought, yes, this is it. My career is made. But we need you to go and get some television experience. And I said, I've got television experience. And they said, no, we mean, you know, we need in consumer stuff. So I got sent up to Birmingham to work on the really useful show, which with Ruth Langsford, who is lovely. So I'm in Birmingham, you know, it's the 90s. I've got huge hair in the morning. and I'm a reporter on this show, which was really, really good fun.
Yeah.
And I got into the lift, and a voice from the back of the lift said, oh, hello, Charlotte. And it was a guy I'd worked with at Five Live who was by this point running the Rural Affairs Unit and had mucked up the rotor and said, well, you know, you can present radio, can't you? And I said, yes, why? And he said, I need someone to do farming today. And I said, I don't know anything about farming. And he said, don't worry, just read the words. So I said, yeah, sure, you know, I can do that. It's early in the morning. It was, I think the first couple I did might have been live. And then it was recorded. And so it was easy to, you know, to fit in. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I fell into it. You know, it was completely random.
Chance. Did you have any knowledge at all of the world of farming then, or just not even a rudimentary knowledge?
Not really. I mean, no. I'm not, no. No, God, no. The gaps in my knowledge are impressive to this day. No, I didn't know anything about farming. I didn't understand it, really.
Yeah.
I remember doing a piece about, they'd launched a leaflet on farm safety. And
okay.
They were describing all these awful accidents. And I was like, how's a leaflet going to help? Yeah, I remember being utterly dismissive.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no, I didn't know anything, actually, looking back. Yeah. Less than nothing.
How's working on the show changed over the years?
Oh, God, completely. So it used to be much more... I suppose it was a bit more political, maybe. We covered every spit of every political row about farming. We used to do really long interviews. So the tradition was to do like a 20-minute interview and then cut it down to 5 minutes, which actually is really hard. It's really hard to give a fair interpretation of 20 minutes in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So we don't do that anymore. That's, you know. There were far fewer farmers on it, largely because nobody would talk to us.
No.
You know, farming's changed so much. But, you know, you'd ring someone up and say, do you want to be on the radio? And they'd put the phone down on you. Mm. You know, that it was so different. Yeah, so it has changed a lot. And it's there's a lot more being outside on it.
Yes. Okay.
Which I think is really important, because most people who listen to farming today are not farming. They might have interest. But it's a lot of people who just happen to be up early, loads of commuters. Loads of people who wake up early would listen. And so you need to make it nice to listen to.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to give them a sense of what being outside is like and what it's like, really.
I'm interested in what you said then about farmers not necessarily wanting to talk to you in those early days. I think we have got a lot better in recent times as communicating as an industry. And we talk about that a lot in farming. How do we communicate with our consumers better? I mean, from your point of view, would you go along with that? We have improved over the last sort of 4 or 5 years.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, it's unrecognisable. I mean, it's absolutely unrecognisable. The industry is so open. I mean, Open Farm Sunday, which I think has been amazing. And people like Ian Piggott and yourself and this sort of slightly younger generation of farmers who are much more open about what they're doing. It's completely changed. So now if you ring a farmer up, they'll definitely talk to you. Even if they don't want to go on the radio, they'll explain it to you.
Yeah.
Because they're anxious that everybody understands it in a way that they weren't before. Because you weren't farming when I first started in the 90s. Farmers weren't really interested in consumers. Because they sold to whoever who did something with it, and then it went to consumers. It wasn't farming's job, if you like.
No.
Farmers didn't see it as, why should I? Why does it matter?
Mm.
Whereas now, farmers are much more aware of consumers, and they're much more aware of the fact that as the politics change, they're going to need that support. They're going to need people to at least understand what they're doing.
Mm.
And then decide with knowledge whether they support it or not, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
It's completely different.
So what have been some of your highlights over the years? You've spoke to all kinds of high-profile people, and what's been your favourite things?
Yeah, we went to Argentina in the middle of Foot and Mouth in 2001 because the Argentinian farming community, and particularly their Minister of Ag, was furious with the way that we were dealing with it. And that was fascinating to go and see a completely different way of farming. That was amazing. Princess Anne and Prince Charles, I mean, you know, diametrically opposed on their views to farming, but fascinating people. Love to get them together. That would be brilliant. But I've interviewed them both separately. And because I was on the board at Oxford for a few years, worked with Princess Anne there as well.
I'd love to interview Princess Anne. I think yeah, should be fair.
Me too. Yeah. We once went to do. I don't like horses. I'm from the village of Quorn in Leicestershire. they'll probably disown me. I'm not keen. I'm basically frightened of them, and it's become a bit of a standard joke at farming today. And we went to do something. We were doing the equestrian industry and how much money it's worth and how important it is. And we went to do a 3-day event in somewhere, Gatcombe. And I didn't even think about it. And we arrive, and we're with my lovely producer, and we're laughing, and I'm making her go near the horses because I'm too scared. And the organizer says, "Would you like to speak to Princess Anne? Because she's here, obviously." And we went, "Oh, all right then." So I am doing my absolute best to ask intelligent 3-day eventing questions of Princess Anne, who can spot a fool. And so she said to me, I don't know, halfway through my second question, "How much do you actually understand about it?" Honestly, not very much. I don't really see the appeal. And she spent about an hour with us explaining 3-day eventing, reminiscing about going around the world with the Olympic team. I mean, she was brilliant. She was really, really funny. And she said to me, she said, "I could teach you to ride." And I went, and I just thought, oh my God, how terrifying with that. It was great. So and then bog snorkeling, obviously, which is the thing on Countryfile that always gets shown. And I only agreed to do it if they sent me a wetsuit, and they sent me the wrong size, so I had to do it without a wetsuit. I smelled for days, and I was rubbish.
Has new media pushed farming today on at all? I'm quite interested in this. There's all these sort of upstarts with podcasts and YouTube channels, etc. now. And some have got, have got quite big audiences, especially the YouTubers. But in my opinion, as a long-term Farming Today listener, the show has got better and better in recent years and remains as relevant as ever. So is that has that had an influence?
It has pushed us. I think we're less formal now.
I
think that's a result of the podcasting, I think. Because when you listen to a podcast, and we just drove to Scotland and back, so I listened to a few. And when you listen to that, it's just people chatting, isn't it? Whereas sometimes on radio, in the past, we've been very, "Well, hello, we're the radio now, and I'm going to write in grammatically perfect sentences, ever so slightly talk down to you." And so that's been really liberating because I am much more, and particularly during lockdown, I am literally sitting on my sofa with a microphone. And we've been much more relaxed about it. And I think that has really helped, actually, because to be honest, it's just someone chatting, isn't it? So I think that's different. We've worked harder on the sound of it.
Yes.
So that we do work hard to get sounds of the countryside in and more voices. We've worked really hard to try and get a better diversity of voices. So it's not just the leader of this and the chairman of that. And and we've worked hard to get more women on because, I mean, farming is not as male as it would seem, I think. When you, a lot of people who are involved in farming organisations tend to be a bit older because that's when they've got people, sons or daughters who can take over the farm a bit. And so we've tried to get that younger generation on and hear from them because everyone's doing something slightly differently and that's always really interesting. And one of the things that was invented during lockdown was this thing where we just said to a random selection of farmers, really, just tell us what you're doing, tell us about your week. And that was really interesting because they weren't doing anything special, but they were just, doing whatever they were doing on the farm.
So you often interview very high profile people, as we've just mentioned, Princess Anne, sometimes politicians, front bench. Sometimes you have to really put them over the coals and ask some difficult questions and hold them to account. Do you enjoy the cut and thrust of that?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's frustrating because a politician's job is to get their one point across. So you can say, "What's 10 plus 10? And they'll say, "I'm really glad you asked me that because our new initiative will be very important for revealing the answer of what 10 plus 10 actually is." I mean, who can blame them? If I were on the other side of the fence, this is what I'd be advising them to, which is just, if you talk and talk, then firstly, radio listeners hate it when people interrupt. So they could do an answer which would last, say, a minute. Well, I've probably got 4 minutes for the entire interview. So that's not going to help. So then you do interrupt and you get lots of letters saying, please stop interrupting, you're so rude. If I did, they would just talk for four minutes and it would be ridiculous. I think it's, I do enjoy it, but it can be quite frustrating. And I think maybe we are moving away from that slightly adversarial feel where I ask a question and it's sort of this tone of voice, where we're actually just trying to find stuff out, particularly at the moment. We're just trying to find stuff out, and you can like it or hate it, but at least we'll know what it is.
And have you always been naturally confident when you're interviewing people and sort of quick on your feet, or has that been something that's come with experience?
It's a bit of a front, to be honest, because I'm just really lucky that my voice doesn't shake. So when I get really nervous, my legs shake and my voice doesn't.
Do you still get nervous?
If you're not scared, you're not doing it right.
That's good to hear.
I think you've got to be a bit scared, haven't you? Else you get too comfy. Yeah. And when you get comfy, that's when you make mistakes, actually, because you don't check. I get really scared when I'm doing a politician, because you want to get it right. You want to get your question so that they can't wriggle around it. You want to, you know, and there are times when you just slightly lose the plot and you go off down a blind alley.
Yeah.
And you think, oh no, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
It's up down this. Yeah. So I still get scared. I still get anxious. And I still, even just when you're on a farm, you know, you want to bring out the best in people. That's my job, really.
Yeah.
We have a joke that I'm always saying, you know, darling, it's all about me. I don't know why you've turned up to the interviewee. and I wish that were true. But actually, it's not about me. And I think that's the most important thing to know as a TV or radio presenter doing what I do. For some presenters, it is all about them and they're going around the world or whatever it is they're doing, and it's about their experience. But in my role, it's absolutely not about me. It's about the people I'm interviewing, and it's about me trying to bring out the best in them so that they can put their story in the best way and their side of the story. And tragically for my ego, it's not about me.
So okay then, asking for a friend here. If you are interviewing someone, whether it's on Farming Today or on Countryfile, what is the secret to getting the best out of them?
Well, I always describe myself as a gob on a stick. So when I meet people and I say, I'm Charlotte, I'm the gob on a stick, you know, I try just to relax them, particularly with TV. With radio, it's not so bad because it's a bit like this and you're just chatting. But with TV, it's like this, but with a big camera over my shoulder pointing at you.
Yeah.
And it's a really weird experience. And the main thing is, as I famously once said to a Secretary of State for the Environment, don't look into the camera, because if you do, you'll look like a politician and no one will believe a word you say. But so it's really, I know, can you imagine? It's really difficult. So you've got this big camera and you're trying to look at me and not look at the camera. It's really an alien experience. So I just tried to reassure them that it's recorded. We can do it 20 times if that's what it takes, and to try and relax.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, to try and, it's just chatting. You know, it's just chatting.
It's just putting people at ease, I guess, isn't it? It's just making them feel comfortable, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how did you get involved with Countryfile initially?
Well, at the time, we were in Birmingham, and Farming Today was sort of in kind of an offshoot of the Countryfile office. So Countryfile was sort of around me. And there was a really nice series producer called Patrick, and I went to see him and just said, I'd like to work for you. And he said, okay, we'll give you a try. And I did something on animal transportation, I think, was the first one I did. Again, the more newsy side of things. And that was great. You know, I was on the telly with John Craven.
Was that your first TV presenting gig?
No, because I've been on, I've been on East Midlands Today. So I've done regional news, and I'd done producing and reporting and presenting the sport there, and had learnt a hell of a lot. I mean, that was a fantastic experience, and I've made some fantastic friends there as well. And a part of my heart will always be in the East Midlands, I think. I mean, it's where I grew up, and then it's where I worked, and it's a really lovely place. So I'd done that, but there was a difference, particularly in the BBC's eyes, between regional television and proper television.
Okay.
Albeit daytime at the time on Country Farm. So yeah, there was a difference. So, but I mean, it's the same skills. So yeah, it's great.
And what's your favourite ever feature that you've been involved in on Country Farm? I mean, you've done all sorts of things over the years.
I think probably either bog snorkeling, just simply because it was so funny. And then there was one where we were doing something about some reform of the common agricultural policy. I mean, really, how do you make that interesting for
that
anybody?
Sounds fun.
You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, you'd have a hard time selling that to farmers, wouldn't you?
But anyway.
Anyway, so the very creative director, I remember we were doing, we had all sorts of toy cows and ducks and things, and we did it with that. And that was really funny.
Yeah.
And I was proud of that, that we'd done something funny about cat. You know, it was actually informative, but quite entertaining. And then of late, the things I've really enjoyed are the ones where I've worked with Tom and Adam, and we've sort of gone off in three different directions, and that's been really fun because usually you're on your own.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to work with the others. And then of late, I've also started sort of presenting the program again as well, and that's been nice because you get to work with Anita or whoever, and that's a hoot because I mean, you know, some of the women on Countryfile are brilliant. I mean, Anita and Helen and Ellie, you know. Get the four of us in a room and it's just a lot of laughing. You know, they're really lovely.
Yeah. I mean, you all appear to just get on really, really well.
Yeah, which is lovely, really.
Yeah.
We've had Country Farm Live, which sadly was cancelled this year for obvious reasons, but over the past few years we've had that. And that's been really nice because it's sort of 4 days where you actually hang out and get to know people a bit better. We do get on, genuinely, which is lovely, really.
Yeah. Am I correct in thinking you also got stuck whilst abseiling once on top of a cliff?
Yeah, I'm a fully paid up coward. So there was me and a load of, I think they were 10-year-olds. I mean, they weren't old children. I'd interviewed them about, I think they were inner city kids and they were going out to the country and all that. And they were really fun. And then they said, well, you'll have to do it. And I went, okay, you know, terrified. Yeah. And when I say cliff, in my head, it's you know, slightly smaller than Everest. In reality, it's probably, I don't know, 20 feet off the ground or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm hanging there like this, and I couldn't do it. You know, when you just can't, I couldn't let go and go down. And in the end, these 10-year-olds climbed up the cliff and then abseiled down really slowly with me. I mean, it was humiliating.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, brilliant variety of things. Country Farm does get a bit of stick from some sections of the farming community, with many saying that it doesn't accurately reflect the realities of country life. How do you respond to that when people say that to you?
Yeah, very few of them say it to me. They mainly say it on social media.
So on Twitter.
I wish they would just say it to your face. I get where they're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lifestyle show. It's a lovely Sunday evening. It's not aimed at the grit. But every week you get me or Tom, you know, the doomster himself, the grimkeeper, doing something about the realities. Mm. And you know, some people don't like it when we do that. But I think that's really important. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? But I think it's really important that on this primetime show there is space for the really difficult bits about trade negotiations, for the really difficult bits about farming. You know, it's hard.
Mm.
And so I think it's important that it covers that honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see people's frustration. It's not a farming show. Mm. It really isn't. But there are, I think, down to the success of Country Farm, there are a lot of very successful farming shows. I mean, they don't get 7 million, they're on BBC2, they get really good audiences.
Yeah.
Things like This Farming Life, like the Country Showdown one. Mm-hmm. Channel 5 have got a farming programme on at the moment with Helen Skelton and Jules Hudson. None of that would have happened without the success of Country Farm.
Yeah.
And so part of me thinks, what other industry gets an hour every week? Every Sunday night. And yes, I get the frustration that it's not covering, but it's, you know, the nitty gritty, but it isn't the farming press. That's not what it's for. It makes me sad. It makes me sad because some of the criticism is so vitriolic and is from people who haven't watched it in a while.
Yeah.
And I get that. I get that that's not what they want, and that's fine. They don't have to watch it, but they don't have to slag it off when they don't watch it.
No. Well, I interviewed Adam Hansen a couple of years ago because he came here and did a feature for me, and I interviewed him while he was here. And he said that because of that, he can't even go on social media. He just doesn't. He has a social media account, but he can't engage because he would find it so difficult because he's so passionate about the farming industry, and he really I've met him now briefly, and he really does care, and he would find that too difficult. And I thought that was very sad that he can't.
He's very aware as well of as his sort of, he is the farmer for many people. He's the farmer, and he shows, I think, the realities of farming on his, I mean, obviously, not everybody has loads of weird rare breeds in a farm, but he also has a big arable concern. And obviously his farm park has just been shut for 2 wet summers?
Mm-hmm.
And now they've been shut. I mean, it's not an easy business to run at this point.
Not at all, no.
Not at all. And neither is the farm. So until you get that and Tom or me being miserable, there's a lot in it, I think.
There is,
and I don't mind people who watch it and say we've got stuff wrong. I mean, we have made mistakes, and that's been appalling. But it annoys me when people who don't watch it get so angry about it, because I just think, well, have a watch, and then if you still hate it, that's fine. Just don't watch it again. But why feel the need to be so nasty? But then that's social media, isn't it? I mean, I mean, I'm there for the giggles and frankly to Nick's stories, that's the best thing about social media, because a couple of farmers will say something and you'll think, oh, okay, and you go away and find out about it, so that's brilliant for us.
Yeah,
but I think that I don't get the shouting at each other thing.
No,
I'm not a very confrontational person, and I just don't quite get that, because nobody's wholly right about anything, are they?
Nobody wins from it, do they? Nobody wins from arguing with people on Twitter, do they?
Yeah, exactly. So my Twitter, and also because the BBC is very particular about, I'm not allowed to have a public opinion on anything.
I'm sure.
Which is quite a relief, really, for Twitter. So I do lots of pictures of mud.
Yeah. And Adam's talked, he's lost cattle to TB and things, hasn't he? Yeah. And he's done really good features on that, and which is, I guess, an extremely difficult subject to cover
because
like that.
Yes. And TB is really difficult, particularly because you can get two eminent scientists on. He will talk eminently about the science and come to completely different conclusions, which makes it very difficult when you're trying to do it succinctly. And clearly, because everyone's got an opinion. So every time you do it, you will get somebody telling you you've done it wrong.
At the same time, though, as you mentioned, it is watched by 7 million viewers most Sunday evenings. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, it is a real regular part of their lives that they enjoy and they find very comforting. And I'm sure during lockdown, when people haven't been able to get out and about, even more so, that must be quite a special thing to be part of.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because I've been on Countryfold twice, if you like. So I was on it for 10 years when it was a daytime program, and then there was how do I describe that, then the BBC sacked me for being old, and I went off and did other things, and then eventually I've sort of finagled back on because I don't know, they haven't noticed that I'm still old or even anyway, so that when it was a daytime program, I used to get recognized in National Trust properties and Waitrose and once memorably in the sea, when I was shouting at my toddler daughter at the time, not to come into the sea. And, I've got quite a loud voice when I need. And I was saying, stay there, stay there, stay there. And desperate, I'm a rubbish swimmer, but desperate trying to swim back towards her. And this woman who was sedately swimming next to me went, oh, hello, Charlotte. That's weird. That's really weird. And then since I've been on it this time, I get recognised on the bus and all sorts of places, which is really odd. I only do Countryfold. I'm not on telly a lot. It's not part of my life experience to be recognised randomly in the street.
Yeah.
I find it absolutely peculiar. Adam Henson writes about it actually in one of his books, and he was talking to me about it, and he said, when Countryfold went prime time and he was suddenly very famous, and he said that his family would notice it because people would smile at him in the street as if they knew him.
Yeah.
And they'd think, who's that? Why is the woman smiling at dad? And he suddenly realised It was a country pub, yeah. Yeah. But it's been really lovely. And most people just say nice things to you. You know, they don't come up and say, I hate your program. They don't come up and say, you know, oh, lovely, and how's John? And that kind of thing. You know, it's nice.
So, yeah. So you mentioned the two spells on Country File. As you said, in 2009, you were one of four female presenters dropped by the BBC. And you subsequently heard that it was because, and I quote, you were not young or pretty enough, which now in 2020 seems unbelievable, really. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, obviously, we didn't know that. So, you know, we were called, I was called in, and the series producer said, it's amazing, we're going to prime time. Sadly, you're not coming. And at the time, I had my children really late. I didn't have kids till I was 40. So at the time, I think the kids were something like 2 and 4, okay. Something like that. So the travelling was unbelievably hard. So if I'm honest, my actual first reaction was relief. And I rang my husband and said, well, I've had a good run. Who'd have thought I'd lasted till I was 40 something in telly.
And
I was really sad. I mean, I was really, really sad, really sad. But I tried to be as professional as I could. I helped the team as they were, you know, preparing for this new program, and I stayed on doing stuff for the old program. And then Miriam had done a bit of digging and had sort of realized that, hang on a minute, you know, only four of us who went, we're all middle-aged, the men were saved, they're older than us, you know. And she decided to take the BBC on an ageism thing and sexual discrimination. And I did go and talk to her lawyers, but by this point I was working really part-time, so I wasn't much help really in the court case. But I did give evidence for her, which was really hard. Because in these sorts of cases, you have friends on both sides. So Miriam is a really good friend of mine. I do think we were badly treated. But equally, on the other side, you know, the people I'd worked with 4 years on Country File, who largely it wasn't their decision, it was a decision taken higher at the BBC, but they were having to give evidence as well. And it was a really, really difficult time and really unpleasant for everybody involved. And having watched now Carrie Gracie and Samira Ahmed, because I've been involved in that equal pay battle as well, go through similar things, it is just, it takes a real toll. And I think for Miriam, she was so brave. I mean, I have so much respect for her for doing it. It's a really hard thing to do. And it's really hard for everybody on the other side as well, you know, for the producers that you've been working with and everything. So it was horrible. It was just generally horrible. And so when she won, I naively thought, the BBC will ring me up and give me my job back now because it's been proved that they were doing wrong. So, of course, you know, phone didn't ring. So eventually I rang the BBC and I said, hello, could I speak to the Director General? And they said, no, who the hell are you? And I said, my name's Charlotte Smith. I was involved in the Miriam O'Reilly case. Immediately I got through to the Director General, at which point I thought, So I went and I did get an apology from Mark Thompson at the time, which was nice. But you don't get your job back. You don't get, you know, that's not how it works. So you, and neither did Miriam, you know. So ultimately it's, you know, everyone says, oh, we'll learn and everything will change. And things have slowly got a bit better, but it's not great for older women at the BBC or anywhere else. And in fact, the way I got back onto Country File was that I carried on doing Farming Today and I worked on other things and did a bit of writing. And then Tom Heap had, I think, 3 weeks off and they just thought we're going to need someone to cover him and bravely asked me. I think probably without asking, I don't know, but I think without asking anybody important at the BBC. And I finagled my way back on, which was good because it was the year I was 50. It was a real boost to being 50, to thinking, yeah, I'm 50 and I can do this.
Yeah, and, I'm sure.
You know,
were you ever tempted to, because as difficult and as it must have been, I'm sure very emotional as well, you must have been angry. Did you ever consider leaving the BBC altogether, just completely ending your association with them?
Yes. I mean, I have a very sensible husband. Okay. Who talked me down. You know, I was all for, I'm going to write my story and sell it to the Mail, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do the other.
Yeah.
And he just kept saying, sleep on it, sleep on it, sleep on it. Because what was the point? really. What would be the point? And I have, you know, Farming Today is a job that I really enjoy. So who would be the winner if I chucked it in over something that had happened in telly? So no, I did. I mean, obviously, I was really cross. But I have a husband who talked me down, luckily, and I stomped around for a bit. And also for me, it was a real loss of identity because I had my kids so late. Mm-hmm. And I think lots of things happen when you have children, however old you are. But I was 40 and then 42, so I had a very definite idea of who I was and what I was doing. And I was really lucky to have children, and I am grateful every day, even though they're now teenagers. But it did make me think, hang on, who am I then? Mm. Who am I was somebody, you know, and now I'm not even the most important person in my own life. And I really struggled with that. I struggled with having very young children, and then to sort of lose half of your work and also with it, how you describe yourself. I'm a journalist. I am on Country File. I do this. Really shook me. Mm. And I think the big thing I took from it is that never again will I define myself through work, whatever that work is, because it had become too important in my life, really. And now I define myself as me and a mum and a wife and a journalist and lots of other things. But I think it was a bit of a wake up call for me there. Mm. And I would always advise people to try and hang on to your life. Yeah. And when you have a job where you travel a lot and it's very absorbing, it's too easy for that to become too important, which I think what it did for me. So it really struck at the core of who I was and shook me a bit.
Mm.
And it came just after I'd been diagnosed with this weird illness as well. And so it was a really hard time.
Do you think, I mean, you said the attitudes are changing very slowly. Are you confident that sort of 5-10 years down the line, it will keep improving and eventually it won't be an issue? Or do you think it will perhaps always be there?
I think it probably will. I mean, we're a very youth-centred society, aren't we? And I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, it's probably getting like that for older men now as well. Mm-hmm. There's also the thing that particularly I think we'll find as we go into recession, if you're older, you're more expensive. Mm-hmm. Generally, and so, you know, you could cut one older person and get two younger people in, kind of thing, or one and a half. So I think that's going to be an issue. I wish I could say that I thought it was all sorted, but I really don't. I really don't think it is. I think there is I don't believe people on Country File care, if I'm absolutely honest. No. You know, I'm not there to be pretty. I'm not there to look elegant. God knows. You know, I'm usually wearing an anorak. You know, I do have my hair blow dried. I just want you to know that. I do have my hair blow dried. And the first thing that happens is I get out of the car and it rains. I'm not sure that audiences care as much as TV executives think they do, but I could be wrong. Who knows? Yeah. No. I hope it will get. I think it, hopefully it will gradually get better. Yeah.
Do you often get young women who want to get into journalism and perhaps especially in agri-journalism, do they often come to you and ask you for advice?
Yes, they do. Yes. And my first advice is don't. go and get a proper job. Yeah. Go and get a job with a pension. I think it's good to know the reality of it, that it isn't a steady job, that you're not going to earn loads of money. Particularly people, I think that TV and radio is really well paid, and it's not. And ag journalism is not paid well either. But it's really good fun. So you just have to weigh up what you want, I think, in your life. But yes, I've mentored a few people actually over the years, and I do enjoy it, although I find it, it's quite challenging. I mean, I've never really run my own career. It's just been a series of accidents. So when you're trying to say to someone, you've got to be strategic, you know, I can kind of hear them laughing and thinking, well, you have.
I think
the really good thing is that when I meet young women now, they are sharp elbowed, and in journalism you've got to have sharp elbows. And my generation of women weren't really, that's kind of not what we were supposed to be, you know. We were supposed to be ladylike and all that, and although we wouldn't think that, when you've been brought up that way, it's sort of very ingrained, whereas you've got to be pushy and you've got to be confident, and that's really good to see. And also the other thing that's been really good to see is that a lot of the women I talk to are doing it for themselves. They're not waiting for someone to give them a job. They've, started a podcast or they're doing a bit of writing, you know, they're not, they're self-publishing. They've got a YouTube channel. Mm. And I think that that's fantastic that people can just get on with it.
Yeah. There's so many options available now, I guess, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So speaking again of young people, you were recently president of the National Federation of Young Farmers Clubs for 3 years. That must have been a brilliant thing to be involved in.
Yeah, I mean, I was so chuffed to be asked, particularly because I've never been involved with young farmers, obviously, because, I mean, there were young farmers, but I looked at them and thought, why would you want to do that? Not really knowing what was in it. And now I wish I'd joined it because it's so varied what you can do with young farmers. If you want to go and talk about sheep in a corner, great, go and do that. But if you want to learn how to public speak or get better at this or that or the other, no, I think it's fantastic. And I think it's not recognised enough because in many areas that the provision for young people is young farmers. That's it. And it's about more than farming, as the slogan has it. You know, they will welcome anybody in a rural environment and just give them something to do, you know, and that's brilliant. And give them leadership roles and be friends. You know, I've spoken to a few people who had really quite serious depression, and part of the help that was available were people from young farmers. You know, they're a really caring organisation. So, no, it's been an absolute privilege to be involved.
They are. My wife and I met in Young Farmers, and so did my parents, and
really?
Yeah, and one day we sat down, my wife and I, and we came up with 30 marriages that we know of our friends that have got that are young farmers.
Yeah, so. See, if I'd have been in Young Farmers, I needn't have waited till I was 40 to have kids. we often used to say that when we were working on farming, and I was in my very single 20s and 30s. In the 30s, I would have been by farming, yeah. And we used to say, yeah, because I was too old then for young farmers. Like, oh, no, if only I'd joined.
you did mention this earlier, but many people won't realise this, and I didn't either, in fact, is that you do have a rare lung disease. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it.
No, I was diagnosed more than 10 years ago now with lymphangiomyomycosis.
Okay.
Which is commonly known as LAM. Okay. And about 150, 200 women in the UK have it. It's vanishingly rare.
Okay.
And I was diagnosed with it because my lung collapsed for no particular reason. And they did some investigations. And my lungs have got holes running all the way through them. And they decided it was this disease. Now, this disease is a progressive disease. So what happens is that for reasons nobody really understands, those holes get bigger and bigger and bigger until you have very little lung function. Mm-hmm. And so I was warned that this is probably what was going to happen, that it could be 10 years to a transplant, or equally I could chug on for ages, nobody really knows. Mm-hmm. So I lived with that, with varying degrees of bemusement, and actually my lung function stayed exactly the same.
Okay.
So 2 years ago, on a Countryfile photo shoot, my lung collapsed again.
Right.
And when I went into the hospital this time, it wouldn't come back up. So they had to do an operation where they stick it all back together. And while they were there, they did a biopsy of my lung and decided that I don't have this disease at all.
Wow.
Hooray!
Okay.
which was great. But they don't know what I do have. I have, quote unquote, weird lungs.
Right, nobody okay.
Can. I've got holes in them and sometimes they collapse. And okay. Nobody knows. Why?
Right, okay.
So it was, which was really weird because that was good news, really. Because
it must have been quite the roller coaster, really.
It was, in the midst of all the misery when I was first diagnosed, and I dealt with it really badly, I have to say. I mean, nobody can tell you how to deal with a diagnosis, but not the way I did. I was really panicky and I told far too many people in a really panicky way, and I was convinced I was going to die, even though I was actually perfectly healthy. And I felt really guilty because the kids were so young and I'd only just had them and I should have had them when I was 20. And oh, it was awful. And after I got over myself a bit and sort of looked at what was actually happening, I calmed down and I joined the support group, which is basically most of this 150 women who have it, who were fantastic. Mm. I mean, these are women who are properly ill, some of them, waiting for transplants or being told they're not eligible. And they were generous with their time and they were reassuring and they were just amazing. So the saddest thing about not having it is that I can't be in the group because they were brilliant. And I really owe them, you know, for restoring my sanity at that time, because they were just, they, they've got this disease, they're living with it in various stages because it's really unpredictable.
Yeah.
And they were just so kind to me when I was just having a bit of a meltdown, really, for no real reason. I should have just calmed down. Mm. And then I did calm down and I'm fine. Yeah. So the only thing was the shield, because they're not sure if I did get COVID, they're not quite sure what would happen to my lungs. I tend to think I'll be fine, but I'm not going to test it.
No, I wouldn't advise. I guess there's no playbook for dealing with those kind of things, though, is there? You know, when someone comes
I don't know. It's really, one of my friends had cancer recently, and we were supporting her through that. And she dealt with that much better than I dealt with mine, I thought. And that was nasty because you get horrible treatments and stuff. I don't know. I think probably what would be great is, and it's very difficult for a rare disease, but they are doing it a bit with cancer now, is that once you've been diagnosed, you walk out and there is somebody there who literally scoops you up and who's been through it and sits down with you and says, breathe, you know. Whereas obviously with a rare disease, that's kind of impossible. But I think we've learned that actually, you know, medically there's all sorts of things that need to happen, but for the mental health of the people going through it, they need that support. And some people reject it. My friend who had cancer, you know, the last thing she wanted to do was go to see other people who were ill. She was really not interested. And I was bemused by that because I found it so helpful. But it's horses for courses, isn't it?
Of course. You know? I've been lucky enough to meet you a few times, and you seem to be someone who loves life, someone who laughs a lot and enjoys every day. Is that a fair comment? And has all this sort of been a factor in that?
Yeah, I think when you're diagnosed, obviously you say, I am going to live every day as if it was my last. Live in the moment. I'm going to, you know, lose weight and be healthy. And you can imagine. Yeah. And then none of the above happens. But one thing I think I am grateful. I am truly grateful to be here, to have my kids and my husband, and to have a functioning life, because I'm much more aware now of just how lucky you are if you're healthy. I had a new knee in January, so I did kind of lockdown before it was invented. So February I was just sitting on the sofa. I got out for a bit in March, and then lockdown was invented. So it's been a real year of being at home, and the knee's been hard work, but I'm really, how lucky is it that my knee really really wasn't working and I can get a new one? You know, so I do try. I mean, you know, my husband would laugh if he were here, because I am the gloomy one of the two of us. I, you know, and I'm always like, yes, but we've got to have a plan B, because that's not working. I am grateful. I am really grateful for what I've got, and I think I appreciate it having lost it. So I really enjoy doing Countryfile. I have no idea how long it will last. I'm really proud to be a 55-year-old woman who has had no plastic surgery. I'm telling, you know, that we're few and far between.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud to be there.
Yeah.
So that's all good, isn't it? It's all good.
You know?
And I make a living doing something I really enjoy doing. So that's pretty good.
It is. Fantastic.
I don't get paid enough.
Well, you know, none of us do we? But
Right.
I've taken up enough of your time, so we'll wrap this up with the five hard-hitting quick questions, if you're ready. Everyone struggles. What is your all-time favourite song?
I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor.
Oh, brilliant. That's such a good choice for you. Okay. Who in the world would you most like to interview?
The Queen.
Really?
Yeah, Adam Henson sat next to her at a lunch. I was so jealous. Yeah, apparently they talked about cows. So I was quite glad that I hadn't had to do it myself, because I know, I mean, I would have been, there would have been a sentence from me about cows, and that would have been it. So they talked about cows. So I'd love to interview the Queen. I'd love to know what she really thinks. And I know she wouldn't tell me, but it'd be great trying to get it out of her.
It would. If the police turned up at your office, the BBC, arrested you and took you away without a word, what would your colleagues there assume that you'd done?
Do you know, I'm going to ask them this later. I'm going to ask them. I think they'd assume that I had been speeding.
Okay.
Or something like that. I think they'd assume a car-related incident.
Mm.
I love cars. We don't have a car anymore because we live in a city, but I do love cars. And I'm a bit of an old lady driver now, but I used to go quite fast. Yeah.
Okay. We've all been watching more TV over the last several months during lockdown. What's your favourite ever TV character and why?
I decided to go with my first instinct on this, and that was Mr. Ben was the first thing that popped into my brain.
Okay.
Remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this.
I do. I'm aware of
it. It was a kids' TV series where Mr. Ben, who was a cartoon, a very sort of English, restrained cartoon, would poodle into a shop and then he'd go into the changing room and end up somewhere else. And I love that idea of just ending up somewhere else.
Yeah.
Fair. So I think I'd go with him.
Okay.
Or I'd love a walk-on part in Succession.
I haven't seen that yet.
Honestly, once you start watching it, you're completely addicted. About a multinational company owned by a family. I'm sure it has no parallels with real life. Who's gonna get it, you know? I'd love a walk-on part in that because it's great.
I'll have to check that out. We're watching the Americans at the moment, which is very good.
We watched that. Yeah, it's really good.
We're on sort of series five, so once we're through that, we'll be looking for something else. So
We just started Modern Family. The kids said, "Let's watch this." I think we're on season two. There are nine.
I love Modern Family, and it gets better. It's one of those rare series. I mean, and Phil Dunphy is like my idol as a super dad. So
such a doofus, as they would say.
He's very like me. Anyway. Lastly, then, what is we mentioned social media and its impact before? But what is your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow?
I would say it's James Robinson, who I've never met.
He will be thrilled.
Who's up in Cumbria. And through lockdown, that man alone kept me sane. So I did find lockdown very difficult. You suddenly realise, why you spend 2 days away from your family every week. Yeah. What I really missed, and I didn't think I would, was being out on a farm. Mm-hmm. Because it didn't occur to me for the past 2-3 decades, I've spent at least a day a week on a farm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what I do. Yeah. So he just used to post, and still posts, just, here's the pond, here's the this, here's the that. And I was completely addicted to it. So that, I mean, I've never met him, and I will go and meet him. He's very kindly invited me to the farm. I'm going to drag the kids up. And it's beautiful, and it's restful, and it's lovely. And also, he knows it's lovely.
He does.
He doesn't just go, here's a pond. He goes, God, I'm so lucky, here's a pond.
He does. And they are such a lovely family. James is the nicest man. He's become a good friend. I've met him a few times. He's a great guy.
I follow loads of farming accounts, which is hilarious because, you know, it's half shoes and half farming. and it's a joy. It's an absolute joy just to see what people are doing.
Yeah.
You know, and at the moment I'm really enjoying because everyone's posting their yields. And obviously when you look at it, because they just post the picture from the cab and you're like, what does that mean? and then you see the yield and you're thinking, ooh, you know, even I know that's not great.
No, it isn't.
And I love the banter. That's been really fun. Sad in many ways, but yeah, fun.
Brilliant. Charlotte, it's been an absolute pleasure. I don't think I've told you this, but a few years ago at the Oxford Farming Conference, I saw you there and I came over to say hello, but I was so nervous because I don't remember meeting you. Well, you're sort of my broadcasting hero, and I was so nervous, but I did come over and say hello, which I was very proud of.
Yeah, I think that's mad, isn't it? That's utterly mad. Because as you have proved, all broadcasting is chatting. All you do in this really lovely way is chat to people and bring out their stories. And
I suppose like you, I'm a people person and I'm interested in their stories. I'm just interested to how they've got to where they've got. So
yeah. And it is, and people are endlessly interesting.
They are endlessly interesting. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and hopefully
thank you so much for asking me.
We'll see you in person sooner rather than later.
Cheers.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.